to introduce to you Kathleen Devlin from the Ontario Teachers Federation. Kathleen serves as the Director of Policy and Public Affairs, and in that position she advises the President and Executive Director of the Ontario Teachers Federation on all matters related to communications and education policy. The OTF represents 144,000 teachers in Ontario. Kathleen started off here in BC, educated at UBC and Carleton, and teaching both here and in Ontario. She has an amazing career. She worked in the CBC as a writer-broadcaster, served on the political staff at Queen's Park, and now is, as you noted, Director of Policy and Public Affairs. She's here to tell us about the parallel paths of education in Ontario and to give us some tips and some lessons learned so that we can chart our course from their experience. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you very much for having me here today, and I want to especially thank you for fixing the weather for me to come. Every teacher that I know remembers very clearly their very first day in the classroom. I remember my first day, I'm standing in front of my grade 2 class, and I'm thinking, they're smiling, and I'm smiling, now what do I do? And then it suddenly dawned on me, there were 45 of them. But I had a collective agreement that said that was too many students, so my class was split, and I ended up with 22. And I have to tell you that from then on, it was the largest class I ever had. I never taught more than 22 students, but I also want you to take a look at these class pictures. It's a pretty homogeneous group that I taught for the 3 years that I still have the pictures for. They were all still in, no student was an ESL student. I didn't have any student that came to school not speaking English at home. I had only one student that I would classify as having a severe learning disability. And at one point, I had a child in my class who was blind. But that was entirely optional for me, whether or not I accepted that child into my classroom. My, how times have changed. And Mike Harris was our premier. He was elected in 1995. And the provincial election was quite an experience for us. They called it the common sense revolution, which has left us with a feeling that we can't use that expression anymore. Since 70% of the provincial budget in Ontario in 1995 went to healthcare and education, you can imagine where they were going to save their money. However, notwithstanding what they said in the election campaign about saving money, they also said that there wouldn't be any erosion of spending in the classroom and that classroom education was one of their three priorities. However, they ran a really well-prepared election campaign. The New Democratic Party, which was the government, was extremely unpopular following the social contract, and Mike Harris had built himself this image as the tax fighter starting in 1990. And you can see in this answer to one of the standard questions that you ask in an election campaign is why they were talking about education reform. And they were wanting to look at those words, increase efficiency, cost effectiveness, accountability, and responsiveness. I'm sure those all sound very familiar to you. When you come to organize reforming education, as you all know, you can reform governance, you can reform curriculum, you can reform the organization of the schools, and they did all three of those. But the goal should be better education, not cost effectiveness. And that the government was elected on reducing taxes, but they came in with an $11 billion deficit on a $40 billion budget. So with 70% of the budget going to health care and education, and they also ran on a campaign that you can't trust the school boards because they're going to spend your money. I've been thinking a lot about this over the last few years, and I've decided that you've really got two things when it comes to influencing what's going on in education. You can look at politics, or you can look at public policy. And there's an expression in politics that good public policy is good politics. But what we've been seeing recently is that good politics is good public policy, and I don't subscribe to that belief. The Common Sense Revolution was clearly about politics being good policy. It was developed within the party, and the political staff, which is a true aspect of political policy making. Whereas if you're looking at public policy, that kind of policy is developed. It's often the implementation of the political agenda today that's come from within the party, and it's developed within the ministries. So it's people with no political agenda implementing another political agenda. You know, often the bureaucrats within a ministry just look at what's good for kids and what's good for education. But what you've seen over the time, over the last 10 years, the time that I've been working in this, is that we've seen an erosion of the lines between public policy and political policy. We have the Gomery Inquiry is a classic example of that. And one of the expressions that he used in his report was that the bureaucrats are there to speak truth to power. That's not an easy thing to do. And the way it is, with the blurring of the lines between public policy and political agendas, we've seen it harder and harder for people to bring governments to say that. We also have an increasing role of lobbyists, of which I'm one. We have fewer stakeholder consultations and less input from the stakeholders. And we also have, in my assessment of the situation, we have an erosion of what advocacy is in public perception. To advocate, to be an advocate, and to participate in advocacy is starting to take on a negative connotation in some people's minds. So where does that leave us? That leaves us with two approaches. We can fight the political agenda, and in the Harris years, this is where most of our energy was focused, on fighting the political agenda. So if you look at, bullfights, we're sort of like chasing the cape and not the matador when we're doing the political fight. But we didn't totally abandon the other side, the public policy side. And in some of the issues, that turned out to be more successful for us in influencing the Harris government than the political fight did. But, you know, we can all play this game. We all play at politics.
$800 million in education cuts this year. How will we pay? We'll pay with more crowded classrooms, with less time and attention for every child. We'll pay with more cuts to adult education, with more cuts to classes for children with special needs. We'll pay with the elimination of junior kindergarten. Can Ontario really afford the cost of these cuts? Call now and let your voice be heard. A message from concerned citizens, teachers, and education workers.
That was an ad we ran in 1996. Unhappily, almost every one of those predictions, except the one about junior kindergarten, became true in the Harris years. So sometimes there's no joy in being right. But it was all about cutting costs. And what was their agenda? Their agenda was to reduce costs, to reduce government spending, to reduce taxes. Now I realized as I was reviewing my presentation this morning, I actually have these in the wrong order. They did the last one first. They reduced taxes, and then they reduced government spending, and then they reduced costs. So how did they implement their agenda? Well, in education spending, they blame the school boards. The school boards are out of control. Your taxes have gone up 120% over the last 10 years. What they didn't point out, that at the same time, the provincial government had been putting less and less money into education, so the overall envelope that was spent on education wasn't any larger. It was just that it was coming out of this pocket instead of that pocket, but it was all in the same pair of pants for the same taxpayer. The cause and effect of what they were doing was implementing it. So they decided they were going to be the ones to control education spending, and they uploaded it to the province so they could control the school boards, and they have rigidly controlled school board spending since then. They also looked at how it was funded. They moved the funding for education partially off the property taxes and into general revenues. But They took the taxing and spending power away from school board, but as I said, it all comes from the same place. So how does class size fit into this overall political agenda? And how is changing class size going to get us to a spending control? So the issue about class size actually is not the issue of class size itself, it's the issue of power and control. So if I can control the spending by controlling the class size, then I have the power. Collective bargaining up, and this is from, you may as well look at this now. This is reducing class size in one way. Up until the Harris years, by and large, collective bargaining, which is where class size was reducing class sizes. I don't know any teacher in here who'd want to bargain for larger classes. I don't know any teacher who'd want to bargain for a larger class. The point of bargaining is to reduce the class size. But during the social contract, there was a little aberration because there were some class sizes. Because of the pressures of the finances, class sizes eked up a little bit. But by and large, that was not the goal. But let me tell you how the government politicized the issue of class sizes.
Why do the teachers' unions oppose education reform? The union bosses want school boards to keep the power to raise your property taxes, taxes which rose 120% in 10 years. They want the ability to increase class size through union contract negotiations. They want high school teachers to spend on average 3 hours, 45 minutes a day in the classroom. Higher taxes, bigger classes, less time teaching kids. That's what the union bosses want to protect. The status quo. A message from the Ontario government.
Oh my God.
We really is.
Now it's true we wanted to continue negotiating class sizes, but we didn't want to negotiate bigger sizes, we wanted to negotiate smaller sizes. And they made everything really catchy. They reduced everything to very simple answers to very complex questions. And they also were telling the public that teachers are too self-interested. They can't be trusted. What Kate was saying last night about self-motivation of teachers. And they convinced the public with these kinds of commercials. So what did we do about it? Well, we got mad. That ad actually ran during our two-week political protest, by the way, just to give you another context. So we got mad. But our counterpoint was really a complex answer, and that's the trap you fall into in these political arguments. They had the right has very simple answers to very complex questions, and when you want to correct the record, you get into this really difficult argument to make people understand how the simple answer isn't going to work, because it isn't a simple answer, it's a complex one. But what it also meant is that, well, what we did was we sued them. We took them to court for libel, saying we didn't want to increase class sizes. But we felt like we had lost control of our profession. Our professional judgment was at question. And we are professionals, and we trust in our own judgment. That's something else we heard from Kate last night. We do have a sense of our profession, our work, and what works and what doesn't work. But we settled out of court for a whole bunch of other reasons. It was a very complex time, so I'm just, you know, it's sort of like adapting a book to a movie. I'm taking out all the peripheral issues and just focusing on the class size one. So we settled out of court with them over that a week before we were going to cross-examine the premier. But Harris moved class sizes from collective bargaining into the Education Act and determined that in the aggregate, the class size average across the board, notice all the conditionals here, the class size would be 22 in high school and 24 in elementary. Now my history had always told me that elementary classes were always smaller than secondary classes, so I actually thought they got them mixed up. They meant it to be the other way around. But I'm not a mathematician, I'm not a researcher, I'm not a statistician, but I have an opinion on averages. The average temperature in Toronto is 6.2 degrees annually. But you know what, if you come in July, you don't need your scarf, your hat, and your mittens. Vancouver's average precipitation is 1,219 millimeters. But I don't need to tell you about this one. The average age of a teacher collecting a pension in Ontario is 66.8 years of age. But 30% of our retired, of the 100,000 retired teachers are over 70. The youngest person collecting a pension in Ontario is 5.3 years of age, the survivor. The oldest is 105.7 years.
That's me.
The average fertility rate in Canada is 1.9 children per woman of childbearing age, but I don't know how you fit that 0.9th child into a classroom. But there's another way to look at averages. Stop complaining, Johnson, and just be thankful the class is below average size.